This is a recording of the open session of the Federal Election Commission held on November 19, 2009. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
And this will convene the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, November 19, 2009. And sorry for the delay, but we had some late submitted documents to go over. And I would just point out that these are the documents that were forwarded to me last evening to start looking at. So the hard work on the part of Carolyn, especially, and Commissioner Weintraub were coming to final fruition here. And thank you, Mary Dove, for all the hard work this morning getting these documents ready. Mr. Vice Chairman, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move approval of minutes for Thursday, November 5th, 2009, as set forth in agenda document number 09-75.
Thank you very much. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. The motion passes 6-0. We'll begin with the second matter, notice of proposed rulemaking on federal office holders and candidates' participation in certain non-federal fundraising events. We have David Atkins and Amy Rothstein for the General Counsel's staff to begin anytime. Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, I would note that the documents were submitted late.
Yes. Mr. Vice Chairman, do you have a motion?
I would move that we suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider agenda document number 09-77.
Thank you very much. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None. The motion passes 6-0. Please begin, Counsel.
Thank you and good morning. The draft notice of proposed rulemaking in agenda document 0977 proposes changes to the Commission's rules regarding federal candidate and office holder participation in non-federal fundraising events. The proposed changes are in response to the decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit in Shays versus FEC, which found the Commission's existing rule invalid. If the Commission approves the draft NPRM, the Office of General Counsel seeks the authority to make technical and conforming changes and will submit the draft for publication in the Federal Register. Thank you, and I can answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Councilors. Any comments from the Commission? Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you very much to the OGC staff for all of your hard work on this, to Ms. Smith, Ms. Rothstein, who's back there, and Mr. Adkins. We really appreciate it. And especially to Eric Wang from our staff, who's done a lot of work on this proposal as well. Thank you to my colleague, Commissioner Weintraub, who's helped us with the other NPRMs to finalize something to get out for public comment. Also to the chairman, who came up with a very good idea, I think, and we've incorporated in here to add an additional, what we're calling a reply comment period. So the comments for this NPRM will be due on February 8th, and we'll have something new this time. We're going to try a reply comment period so that persons who submit comments by February 8th will have an opportunity to respond to comments filed by others. And we're hoping that those comments are kept narrow to just commenting on what others have said on this rulemaking. And that second round of comments will be due on Monday, February 22nd, and the hearing on this NPRM will be on March 10th. 2010. Regarding the NPRM, there are three very different alternative proposals in the rule. And there are really not many similarities between any of them. I think, you know, they have very different interpretations of the Shays 3 court opinion, and we anxiously await public comment on it, because I think that's going to be very helpful for us to make some really tough decisions that we'll have going forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I do want to thank Commissioner Hunter and Commissioner Weintraub for working the Commission through this arduous task of coming up with a very wide panoply of theories and concepts on what to do in this case. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also want to thank Commissioner Hunter and Mr. Wang, as well as Claire Rajan on my staff, and the excellent OGC staff for all of their efforts. A lot of work went into these three documents. I think in some ways people thought, well, this shouldn't be too hard to do. The court said, you know, take out four words. I think it was four words. And so, you know, how hard could that be? And indeed, we have alternative one that pretty much sticks to that, what we call the scalpel approach of just taking out the words that the court found to be problematic in the last rule. But we also have two more alternatives that try in different ways to answer more questions. Some of these questions are questions that the last group of commissioners deadlocked on, so I don't know whether after all the work we put in and all the comments come back, whether we will be able to get any further on this than previous groups of commissioners have. But, you know, it really, we ask, in some ways, we ask the same questions over and over again in the course of this document. And it all comes down to what the provision means in the statute that says that candidates and office holders are allowed to appear and to appear, speak, and be featured guests at state party fundraising, state and local party fundraising events, and what does the court opinion mean that that said that our last rule was not an adequate way of interpreting that provision, and where do we go from here? So I think it'll be interesting to see what people have to say about it, and we'll see what we can make at it out of it at the end of the day, and if we can come up with something. I do think that while in some ways, you know, some people might look at this as something that doesn't have a lot of, could be very narrow in its focus and only speaks to what candidates and office holders can say at these particular kinds of events. But I think that in light of some recent and ongoing litigation, it could actually have some fairly wide-reaching impact because it could affect how candidates and office holders can help to raise funds for all sorts of non-federal purposes. And we could see a lot more of that going on if we have more outside groups that are involved in more independent expenditures. How are they going to raise the money for their independent expenditures? Well, they may ask like-minded members of Congress to help them out with that in various ways. And I think that that is one possible ramification of this rulemaking, that it could affect exactly what those candidates and office holders can do with respect to these outside groups. So could be very narrow, could be very broad. We'll see where we end up at the end of the day. But again, I want to thank everybody who worked very hard on this and all of my colleagues, really, who reviewed many, 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 many drafts before we got to this point.
Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with everything Commissioner Weintraub has said, and I just wanted to add it that not only does the NPRM respond to the Shays 3 court ruling, but alternatives 2 and 3 in very different ways try to provide guidance to the regulated community on an area I think we can all agree is quite convoluted and very difficult to understand. We've had many AOs in the past, as Commissioner Weintraub said, that have deadlocked on a variety of important questions. So both alternative 2 and 3 attempt to provide additional guidance beyond what the court asked us to do.
Thank you. Any further comment? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to support this NPRM, and I also want to thank my colleagues, Commissioner Hunter and Commissioner Weintraub, for the fine work that they did, and also, of course, to the good folks in OGC, who these never get put to bed without a tremendous amount of blood, sweat, and tears being shed. And so, Rosie and David and Amy, thank you very much for all your work. And I also want to thank my two counsel, John Bauman and Kevin Plummer, for all the time and effort they've put into to helping me along with this process as well. This will be the third time. This is hopefully the last of the Shays rulemakings that we'll be having to undertake. This will be the third time we go through this process. Hopefully the third time will be the charm. But as we get ready to enter into the 2010 election cycle, as it starts to get underway in earnest, what candidates can and can't say and what they can and can't do at state party fundraisers and other non-federal fundraising events, I think, is becoming increasingly important that we be able to answer that. And so this is a very critically important rulemaking. And so I'm really looking forward to the comments and the testimony that are submitted, because I think that I think that we will really appreciate and need that guidance, and will be interested in that comment to get the opinions of those on the outside as to how can we most faithfully implement the requirements of the law while also being faithful and to the decision that was made by the Shays 3 court. So I look forward to this process moving along. Again, thank my colleagues for all their hard work on this, and like I said, hopefully the result will be a positive one at the end of the trail.
Any further comment?
not, I'd just like to echo everything that's been said, and with the hope that, yes, I think we owe an obligation to really work on this, to try and come up with some guidance, and hopefully we won't deadlock. And the input that we get from the public might help us along the way. So I'm real pleased to be able to support it and get this on the books. Do we have a motion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let me also thank Eric Hallstrom on Commissioner Marley's staff and Brad Deutsch on your staff, Mr. Chairman, who were also very helpful to me in my thinking and to all of us, I know, as we were going through this. And with that, I move approval of Agenda Document 0977 and direct counsel to make technical and conforming amendments and to arrange for publication in the Federal Register and get us started again. Thanks.
Thank you. I would add, yes, that that Brad does help me with my thinking every day in great ways, along with Stacy and Tom, and we'll talk about that later. Just another comment. When I first got on the commission in January of 06, the first thing I was told is we've got to finish these Shays rulemakings. And Mr. Chairman Toner was then chairman, and I think we had five that spring, and it went into the fall. And so here we are, and maybe actually 3 years later we can do this. So all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much. And Council, thanks very much for everything. Final rules, and Mr. Vice Chairman, do you have a motion?
Yes. I move that we suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider agenda document number 09-78.
Thank you very much. But let's see, we have more than that, I think. Yes.
Right, if I
continue,
just,
please.
And also, if I conclude with that motion, also agenda document number 09-78-A.
Unless you want to change your mind about that one.
Good call. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes 6-0. Thank you. Well, again, we have a. Let's see. Let me grab my portion of the file. Are we ready to begin? We have Tommy Duncan, Rosie Smith, Amy Rothstein, Joshua Bloom, and Joanna Waldstreicher. Would you like to begin?
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission. Before you are two alternative draft documents to implement the provisions of Section 601 of the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act, restricting the use of campaign funds for flights on non-commercial aircraft. The first document, Agenda Document Number 0978, is a draft explanation and justification for the final rules that were adopted by the Commission on December 14, 2007. And the second document, 0978A, contains alternative draft final rules and an accompanying explanation and justification. Pursuant to the Administrative Procedures Act, the notice of proposed rulemaking for these rules was published in October 2007. The rules would apply to all federal candidates, including publicly funded presidential candidates, and other individuals traveling on behalf of candidates and political committees where the travel is in connection with federal elections. I'm happy to address any questions that you might have about either document.
Thank you very much. Any further, any comment to begin with? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, talk about three times the charm. This is the third time that I will be voting on travel rules, and I, my early holiday wish to my colleagues is that none of you will tie or exceed my record on voting on travel rules. First time I voted on travel rules was in 2003, when I was chair. And you may be surprised to hear this, but we had a really hard time agreeing on a travel rule back in 2003. Back then, it was the position of several of us, myself included, that the appropriate fair market value of a trip on a private plane, non-commercial plane, was not the first class rate, but the charter rate, that it just was a more comparable rate because you get to skip the security line, and you don't have to take off your shoes, and you don't have to pay for your peanuts. I mean, in this day and age, boy, you travel commercial, they don't give you anything for free. And often on these commercial jets, you often are treated to the company of a scintillating lobbyist who will be happy to entertain the a member of Congress for the entire trip with his conversation. Personally, I'd rather watch the in-flight movie. I think that may be the downside to traveling on corporate jets, but it does seem to go along with it sometimes. So back in 2003, we had the same actual debate that we've been having recently. What is the fair market value of a trip on a private plane? And I thought then it was charter rate. And lo and behold, we deadlocked 3-3 on that one. And after much back and forth, we ended up with a kind of complicated rule that said, well, all right, it's first class, unless there's no first class, and then it might be coach. And if there's no way of traveling there by commercial jet, then you can, then it's the charter rate, because that would be the only way that one could get from point A to point B. And I voted for that rule. It was a bipartisan vote. Didn't, you know, like it, but I thought it was the best rule I could get, so, and we needed a rule, so I voted for it. Flash forward to Hologa, and all of a sudden, it turns out that some people actually agreed with me. You know, we've got a statute that says in its legislative history, we've got I'm looking at the section-by-section analysis of S-1 by Senate leaders, a document that we relied on heavily when we did our bundling regulation, which says Section 544 includes a separate provision relating to flights on private jets. This provision requires senators to pay full market value, defined as charter rates for a flight on private jets. And there was a lot of talk on the Senate floor, some of which is cited in the footnotes to my to the alternative draft to 0978A, statements like that of Senator Feingold. Any legislation on corporate jets must include campaign trips as well as official travel, because one thing is for certain, the lobbyist for the company that provides the jet is likely to be on the flight, whether it's taking you to see a factory back home or for a fundraiser for your campaign. Even in the words of the alternative draft, the one I'm not going to be supporting, it says at footnote 5, the intent of Section 601 of HLOGA was frequently characterized by its sponsors as an effort to end subsidization of air travel provided by corporations and others to candidates, and thereby reduce the potential for corruption or the appearance thereof. Sorry, I'm flipping around a lot. I got a lot of little taggies here. Leader Reed on the Senate floor said, many people in this chamber flew in corporate jets and paid first-class airfare. He went on to say it was corrupting. Now, it is true that when the Senate passed HLOGA, they did not cover all corporate, all travel under all circumstances by corporate jets, but it just seemed to me then, and it seems to me now, that it doesn't make sense to say that fair market value is one thing if you're traveling on behalf of a principal campaign committee, and another thing if you're traveling on behalf of a political party or a leadership PAC. It seems to be particularly irrational to say it's one thing, you know, if you're a senator and you fly in the morning on behalf of your principal campaign committee, you've got to reimburse at the charter rate. But if you fly in the afternoon to raise money for your leadership PAC, for that, you, the fair market value of that same flight is suddenly now the first class rate. I mean, I think fair market value is fair market value. It ought to be an objective standard, and it ought to be the same. And, you know, there's, I think one can have legitimate debate about what does it mean when Congress is silent, when they cover one piece of a problem and don't say anything about the other piece. And one argument would be, well, they are acquiescing to whatever the rule was before at the FEC in this case for the other circumstances. But another interpretation, I think, is that if that they're going as they're just tackling part of the problem, and they are leaving the rest for us to fill in the blanks. And we've always had the authority to fill in the blanks from you know, for the last 30 or so years, we've had the authority to define what a contribution is. Contribution includes anything of value, which includes a discount off the fair market value for anything, not just flights. And we unfortunately don't have the privilege that Congress has of saying, well, we think we'll only deal with part of the problem. We have to answer people's questions for all of the problem. For any circumstances in which they fly, these questions come in all the time and people want to know what should they pay. So back at the end of 2007, when we were scurrying around trying to get a whole lot of stuff done at the last minute, we managed to vote out a rule on travel. And to my undying frustration, we were not able to get the ENJ done at the same time, so of course the rule never went into effect. And I will be pleased to support today the ENJ that we have before us today in Agenda Document 09-78, which supports that rule, which I think is a better rule and a more rational rule, and a rule that would be easier to implement, and a rule that would make the regulated community's life easier, because if we set up different rates for the same people under different circumstances, I guarantee you mistakes will be made. We are, you know, perhaps part of the problem is the way the statute is written, but I don't think our only option is to hew as closely as possible to the statute. I think we have the authority to fill in the gray areas, and we should do it in the way that is most rational, that is in keeping with the intent behind the provision, which was to eliminate this corporate subsidy, that's what they called it, to eliminate the appearance of corruption when federal office holders and candidates fly at a discount rate on these corporate jets. And I think we could do that, and we should do that, and I wish that we would do that, but we probably won't do that. I had a last-minute inspiration that I sort of ran by some of my colleagues before the meeting, that if we were not going to adopt the rule that we if we were not going to adopt an ENJ to support the rule that we adopted at the end of 2007 to make that rule effective, that a better compromise would be to make the rate determined by the traveler, not by the committee that would be benefited, because it just doesn't make a lot of sense to say that, you know, sometimes fair market value for a senator traveling is going to be first class and sometimes it's going to be charter. And as I said, I think it's going to drive the staff crazy. And it's going to make for a more complicated rule, and that, I think, I'm sorry I didn't think of it until the last minute, because I think that would have been a better approach than the one that's in Agenda Document 0978A. I recognize I came up with it at the last minute, and there's a strong desire to get this done. But I do think that, and that might even require putting it out for comment again, because I, as I said, I thought of it last night. I wish I'd thought of it, you know, 2 years ago, but I didn't. But I think it actually would be worth doing, because I think at the end of the day we might get a better rule out of it, and one that would make it life easier on the regulated community. It would both make more sense, and it would be more in keeping with what Congress was trying to do, and it would be easier to implement. So I know some of my colleagues like sports analogies. That's my Hail Mary pass, throwing it out at the very last second to see if anybody is interested in exploring that option. But having said all of that, that's why I am supporting today Agenda Document 0978 and not 0978A. And the only other thing I want to say is I want to welcome Joanna back from her maternity leave. Just came back from having twins, and as soon as she came back, we were able to get this rule done. You know, that just shows how much we rely on our staff. And of course, I want to thank all the staff who worked on this, which has been a long time in process. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for those comments. Any further comments on this? Mr. Vice Chairman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I plan to support the rule as and the accompanying explanation and justification is set forth in Agenda Document 09-78-A. I appreciate the discussion that the Commissioner Weintraub just had, and we've talked offline about this issue as well. And I think that many of the points that she brings up are certainly valid ones. And I don't think that that the policy arguments that she sets forth are unreasonable. When looking at this this rulemaking on the campaign travel provisions in the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act, I looked first and foremost at what were the policy choices that were made by Congress, and as they were actually translated into the statutory text, there are always a lot of statements, floor statements, you know, press statements about what congressmen or senators intend when they and what they're hoping legislation will accomplish. But I think that kind of the touchstone of our analysis of what Congress intended is the actual statutory text itself. I think legislative history, I can't remember the judge, once likened legislative history to going into a cocktail party and avoiding the people you don't want to talk to and picking out the few friends you do want to talk to. And so sometimes legislative history, using that as a guide for how to determine how to craft a rule is not always. It can be helpful to an extent, but it has hazards as well, because there's oftentimes very conflicting, you know, conflicting viewpoints out there in the congressional record. And as I looked at the rule, the proposed rule in 09-78-A, I think it faithfully implements the policy choices that were made by Congress when it enacted the law. And it's important to remember that Congress, when it was debating these provisions, it wasn't doing so in a vacuum. It was doing so against the backdrop of the regulatory framework that was established by the Commission in the 2003 campaign travel rules. And so Congress was well aware of that framework, and when it was considering how to alter it, it chose to alter it only with respect to candidates, authorized committees, and House leadership PACs. Other individuals and entities were not affected and were still subject to the pre-existing regulatory framework, so other entities such as political party committees and PACs. And that was Congress's decision. I think there are reasonable arguments about whether Congress should have gone in another direction, but it didn't. That's what they actually enacted in the statute. And so, because the proposed rule that I'll be supporting, I think, accurately reflects congressional intent as it was expressed in the actual statutory language, I'm happy to support it and will be voting for it. And I once again want to thank staff, Rosie Smith, Amy Rothstein, Joanna Wallstrecker, welcome back. And I also want to thank Eric Brown on Caroline Hunter's staff, who really did yeoman's work on the rule, on the ENJ, and answering questions that we had along the way. And I really want to thank him, as well as thanking my own staff for the fine work that they put into this as well.
Thank you. Commissioner Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am prepared to support the ENJ as set forth in Agenda Document 0978. While I wasn't here for the previous versions of this rule, or when this particular rule was adopted, I'm happy to support the explanation and justification that will give it full effect, because I believe it accurately reflects the rule that was adopted by the Commission, and I think it's the right rule for implementing this provision of HLOGA. HLOGA, the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act, is what prompted this rulemaking, and it came about after several lobbying scandals came to light and was an effort, in the words of Leader Reid, to restore the faith of the American people in their government. And I agree with my colleague, the Vice Chairman, that sometimes legislative history is a windy path and doesn't actually lead to a clear result. But I've been unable to find any legislative history that suggests that they intentionally wanted to carve out particular payors for Senate travel, as opposed to getting at the fuller problem. Senator Lieberman, in fact, described the existing travel regulation as a loophole. He said, when a member of Congress or a candidate for federal office uses a plane, the ethics rules as well as the federal election rules require payment to the owner of the plane equivalent to a first-class commercial ticket, and this amendment would eliminate that loophole. So I think there's plenty of understanding. What they were trying to get at was, as I think Commissioner Weintraub suggested, about who the traveler is, not just who's paying the bill. That's my view of what the appropriate reading of the statute is. And I think that this the existing rule clearly covers that. Leader Reed also said that this amendment will require members of the Senate to pay the full charter fare if they wish to travel on private airplanes. If a senator needs to fly in a private airplane for any purpose, he or she should be required to pay the full cost of that trip. Clearly, members of the Senate were concerned that when candidates or office holders are permitted to fly on a corporate jet without paying the full rate, the corporate subsidy, as they called it, that fuels the perception that lobbyists or their corporate clients have undue influence over lawmakers. And because the rule adopted in 2007, I believe, covers the entities on whose behalf a senator may travel, I will be happy to support the ENJ. I also think that it's the appropriate policy choice here, because there are times when we hear lots of complaints, and I think many of us would agree that the world of campaign finance is sometimes complex and murky or confusing. And sometimes we can't control the complexity. That is simply how the statutes have been written. And because they've been amended and overlapping, that can sometimes cause confusion. I think some would agree that perhaps, like the IRS code, we should throw it all out and start over, and we could have a much more streamlined law and regulations to go with it. But here we have a chance to create some clarity and make things less complex for the regulated community. So for that reason as well, I think that the original rule that was adopted by the Commission in December 2007 is the right one. With respect to the alternative that is expressed in 0978A, my concern is that it will create this loophole where a member who is flying on behalf of a leadership PAC, not an uncommon thing, will pay one rate, and as Commissioner Weintraub said, it could be within the same 24-hour period. So by removing from its scope the leadership PACs of Senate presidential or vice presidential candidates, this new rule seems to allow what the legislation was intended to prohibit, the subsidization of air travel for members of the Senate or candidates for those offices. I think the same concern exists with respect to when those members travel on behalf of national party committees. So I think that there are a lot of concerns about what's left untouched by the alternative, and that is the reason that I will not be able to support it. I had hoped we could reach some compromise on covering more of this scope. Doesn't appear that there's sufficient interest among my colleagues to cover more than authorized committee travel by those members, and so I will not be able to support the agenda document 0978A.
Thank you. Any further comment? Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome back to Ms. Wallstriker, and congratulations. Thank you to everybody at OGC who's helped us work on this, and a special thanks to Eric Brown, who put together the agenda document 0978A with rapid speed and was able to come up with something that I think we're going to be able to support today. That's the document that I support, and I just wanted to mention that I agree with everything that the Vice Chairman said. This was a decision, you know, based purely on the statute, and our reading is that the statute was not meant to cover all of the travel contemplated and discussed by my colleagues. The concern and the debate about the coverage of the statute is not new. In the 2007 NPRM, which was issued, so that's almost over two years ago, the approach that I plan to support in document 0978A is virtually the same as the one that was presented as alternative 2 in that NPRM. And I'll just read one explanation directly from that alternative in that NPRM. Quote, because non-candidate travel is not addressed in the new law, the existing rate structure would remain the same for all campaign travelers not traveling on behalf of a candidate or that candidate's committee, i.e. campaign travelers traveling on behalf of political party committees, SSFs, and other non-authorized committees. So alternative 2 was and still is firmly based on the statute, and it also had well-reasoned commenter support back in 2007. So as Commissioner Weintraub mentioned, the NPRM was never adopted in 2007, so obviously what gets adopted today will be the rule that governs. And as we've said, I think it faithfully interprets the statute and the lines that Congress drew. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any further comments from anyone else? I'd like to say I was on the commission when we adopted the rules back in 2007, and we went through the same thought process and the same issues that we're talking about today in terms of policy. And we did take a leap in the sense that the statute did not require us to regulate in the area of the breadth that we adopted when we adopted the rules. We never adopted the ENJ. And I support that then and now. I mean, I still think that that was the best decision that could have been made in terms of policy. And we decided to do that, and four commissioners agreed, and we voted for it. And we did it because we felt that Congress had intended that the charter weight was the appropriate fair market value for non-commercial plane travel, and that the first class coach and coach fare was first class and coach fare was simply too low. If we were to retain the first class or coach fare for some committees but not for others, there would be a fair amount of tension in our rules because for the exact same flight, the fair market rate under our rules would be the charter rate for candidates but the first class rate for party committees representatives. I supported it. Now I'd like to see us adopt it, but I'm quite aware that we don't have the votes to do that. Coming up against what we now call the dormancy period, we call it other prospective periods at the time, but we just did not, unfortunately, have the opportunity to adopt the ENJ. We wouldn't be here today if we did, because we did have the majority of the commission there then, and we do not now. I'd like to thank Brad Deutsch for the yeoman's work on putting together and synthesizing the ENJ that we're voting on now, knowing, as all of us do, that we were doing this in order to complete our thinking and make the record of what our policy thinking was at the time. And so I'm pleased to vote for that now. Any further comments? We have a motion. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to make sure I move the right document here. I move approval of agenda document number 09-78, which would make the rule adopted at the end of 2007 effective.
Thank you. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Okay. Commissioner Weintraub, Commissioner Bowerly, and I voted in favor. The Vice Chairman, Commissioner Hunter, and Commissioner McGann voted against. Do we have another motion? Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move approval of the final rules and explanation and justification contained in agenda document 09-78-A and authorize the General Counsel's Office to make technical and conforming changes.
Thank you. Any comment in connection with this motion? No comment on any part? I have a comment because I plan to vote for this, and notwithstanding my vote before. I do this because, first of all, like I say, I still believe that we should adopt, to approve the motion that we just approved. I think the rules we adopted before were the right ones, but I cannot say that the motion before us does not adhere to the statute as adopted in a specific way, and that it's not an unreasonable approach to take. And I think we all agreed that that was not unreasonable then, and it's not unreasonable now, just not our number one view. The question is, if we deadlocked on this, we'd be not providing guidance in the area. And although we have a statute in effect, I think it's best that we try and give guidance as best we can. And this particular rule does track the statute, and the ENJ does as well. And the commissioners knew that I would support it if it did in that regard, and they have prepared the document along the documents along that line. I appreciate it. Another point I'd make is that even during our comments, we did have recognition of the fact that the existing rules could, if not the best at least, be found to be reasonable if we did not adopt them with the rule that we actually adopted, you know, the alternative we adopted back in 2007. And I would mention that Senator Bowman and Senator Feingold in a joint comment said that the unmistakable purpose of these provisions in Tologa was to require senators to reimburse the owner of a corporate jet at the full charter rate, but then went on to say that they, quote, have no objection to other travelers continuing to provide separate reimbursement to owners of aircraft under the Commission's current rules. The Campaign Legal Center in Democracy 21 agreed and indicated their support for, quote, retaining the existing reimbursement rate structure for non-Canada travel, and at the end of that quote. So I think there were some quotes that came that show that if we were to do that, what we're about to do now, it would not be objectionable from that perspective. And I think by having the regulations in effect, it does provide guidance for everyone. The ENJ that supports it gives, or to a large degree, in sync with the ENJ that we had before with respect to that aspect of the rule. And so I'm going to support it when we vote. Further comment? Okay, all in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay. I voted in favor, the Vice Chairman, Commissioner Hunter, and Commissioner McGann voted in favor, Commissioner Bowerly and Commissioner Hunter voted against. Commissioner Weintraub, pardon me. I know why I get you two mixed up sometimes. Do you have the record, Ms. Dove?
Yes.
Okay. In case there was any doubt.
Yeah.
Next matter is consideration of policy to place first general counsel reports on the public record. Yeah. Mr. Vice Chairman, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider agenda document number 09-72-B.
Thank you very much. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. The motion passes 6-0. And are we ready to begin, Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the last open session of the Commission, we presented a recommendation on the subject of putting First General Counsel's reports on the public record. It's contained in document 09-72. There was also a proposal pending by the Vice Chairman, Commissioners Hunter and McGann in 09-72A. That is where the Commission left off in this matter, and we have nothing to add to our presentation from the week before last.
Thank you very much. Are there any further comments? Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank the staff for an excellent and detailed memo that put us in a position to get to this point. And I also want to thank the Vice Chairman in particular for working with me on ironing out a document that we all felt comfortable putting our names on, and that's a good thing. We started with Council's recommendation. I think we, even though it's a shorter document, we ended up with expanded disclosure under this. We're going to have better transparency. It's an issue that's familiar to all of us, whether we were going to, I think we've known for a while we were going to get to this point of putting the First General Counsel's reports back on the public record, and I'm glad that we're there today, and we're going to do it not only prospectively, but retroactively, and fill in all the gaps so that ultimately it might take us a while to, I think some of them are back in the archives, and it might take us a while to dig them all out, but eventually they will all be up on the public record, and the public record will be complete, and that will be a good thing.
Thank you. Any further comment? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the agency that's charged with administering and enforcing the disclosure requirements of the Federal Election Campaign Act, I suppose it's appropriate that that we are adopting a policy that further promotes disclosure and transparency with respect to the deliberative process within the agency when it comes to enforcement matters. And so I am happy that we've been able to get to a place where all six of us can put our names to this new policy. I think it does promote transparency and I think it also in the process promotes compliance, because I think that allows the public practitioners, journalists, others who may be interested in our work to have a better understanding of how we reach the decisions we do, and that gives them, I think, a fuller and more complete view of the legal framework within which we operate. So I'm pleased to support this. I think it's always a positive step when government agencies on their own initiative look and evaluate their current internal procedures and make the necessary adjustments as necessary. So I think that providing more disclosure in terms of putting first general counsel's reports on the public record is a proper thing. So I want to thank Commissioner Weintraub. I'll thank Commissioner McGann for his efforts on this one as well, in terms of the ways he had a lot. One of the underlying documents to this document was one that emerged from his office, and so I think he deserves a lot of credit on pushing this ball forward towards the goal line. And I'm glad that we're in a place where all six of us can feel comfortable about the document on which we're about to vote. If I can just modify my comments just further, I would be remiss also to not point out Ashley Stowe, who is the Republican floater, the person who helps all of the Republican commissioners on our side, who did a tremendous job, not only in terms of crafting the document, but also going through and doing a lot of the legwork and helping flesh out the historical practices of disclosure here at the commission, and was an invaluable resource on that front. And also before, I'd also be remiss if I didn't thank Mr. Calvert and Ms. St. Louis Mathis for the very fine memo that they put together, which also provided a tremendous amount of rich historical detail on the disclosure practices of the commission throughout its history. So I hope I haven't missed anybody. If I have, then I'll track you down and give you a good pat on the back afterwards.
Thank you very much. Any further comments? We have a motion. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of our new proposed statement of policy regarding placing of first general counsel's reports on the public record as set forth in agenda document number 09-72-B.
Thank you very much. Any further comment? If not, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much, counsel. The next item on the agenda is adoption of a policy to prepare and publish a guidebook for complainants and respondents in enforcement matters. I put this on the agenda because of some work that had been done to try and synthesize some of our publications on some aspects of what we do in enforcement, and to bring this into one document for people to read who really don't understand how we get the job done. This is not a new idea, but it did kind of, in my view at least, come to the fore because of the exercise we went into in early spring of this year in connection with our agency procedures. And I think we all realized that there are a number of misconceptions about how we get the job done. I think one commissioner mentioned to me that a guidebook like this, he said, "Do you mean that would you really like to tell the public what only 14 FEC lawyers in Washington, D.C. really know?" And I think that whether it's an exaggeration or not, it did make the point that there's a lot of misconception and just a lack of information about how we do our work, and typically that gets translated into criticism, much of which would be unnecessary if people really understood the kind of work and the kind of the procedure that takes place and the efforts that's been made this year and last, and for example under Commissioner Weintraub for hearings, to really bring a fairer process into one that is kind of a hybrid, in the sense that we look to see where we investigate and then we proceed on with sometimes even litigation. So we kind of move from one responsibility to another. So what I did, and I would like to compliment the Office of General Counsel, who suggested in March of this year that it wouldn't be a bad idea to have a guidebook and would support the concept and be willing to work on it. I did ask Tom Anderson in my office to begin to see what we could do and to put together kind of a table of contents of what a guidebook would look like. And Tom did a wonderful job. Modified it to some degree. At that particular time, I was really thinking of a guidebook for respondents, because we do have some guidance for complainants, but none for respondents, and those are the ones that get caught up in what we what we call enforcement. So as it went on, and Tom, in his very easy style, began to work with other people in the staff and with OGC, and came up with a very, very nice draft with input from people on how we could set forth what our policy is. Unfortunately, as with many things, things didn't get done as early as I was hoping they'd get done, but they did get done, and that's the first major thing in terms of providing a draft for us to start looking at. With all of the things that we had on our plate this year, it was hard to ask people to devote themselves to this. And sometimes I felt that if they have something to work on, then it helps us focus a little bit on our conversation. And so I had in mind to even put this on blue, which means put it in public, the public eye. But in talking to the rest of the commission, the view was if we put some effort into it and gave it the elbow grease within the next few weeks, we could probably come up with a better product and one that would be more akin to the views of all of us. So that's what we're going to do. And I have commitments from some commissioners that will be ready to vote on December 3rd. Others have said they'll begin right away to start looking at it. And that's good enough for me. So we'll start to do that and hope to have a vote on a guidebook by December 3rd. So I want to thank the commissioners for the willing to start focusing on this. We have some of these hard, thorny issues behind us, and maybe we can actually get that job done. So that would be that's my speech on this particular item, and then we can now move on to co-sponsorship of 2010 Cogle Annual Meeting. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say that I have committed to the chairman to work on this. I pleaded with him not to try and get this done today because we had two other rulemaking documents that we were trying to get done today, and I was personally swamped. And I appreciate that he didn't try to force that. But I do commit to doing this. I think that providing more transparency, as we did in the previous vote, is a good goal for us. And I just want to point out that there is a summary of our enforcement process on the website now. It is oddly enough listed under filing a complaint, and we probably ought to retitle that, but it does provide a summary of the entire enforcement process, and it's a place to start. So we've got some information up there, and if we need to expand that information, that sounds like a great goal, and I'm happy to commit to working on it with you, Mr. Chairman, and I thank you for bringing this issue forward.
Well, thank you very much. When Commissioner Weintraub comes into my office, she gets my attention, I will say that. Mr. Vice Chairman?
Did you have a comment?
Oh, I didn't see that. Excuse me. Anyone else?
I'll just say that I think anything that we can do to promote greater understanding about the mechanics of the enforcement process is a positive thing, and so I look forward to working with my colleagues to see where we can go on this project.
Thanks very much. All right, at this point, we'll move on to the item entitled Co-Sponsorship of 2010 Cogle Annual Meeting, and Art Forster, our Chief Communications Officer, if you have a moment, tell us a little bit about that. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. Before you, the document outlines a request from the Council on Governmental Ethics Laws, an organization that the agency has been a member of and been very active supporter of their work for many years. They have invited us to co-host with them their 2010 conference here in Washington, D.C., which is going to be in December. The specific request is for some manpower and printing support, audiovisual support, which we believe is well within our capability of supporting at minimal cost. We've confirmed that the printing required can be done in-house, not external. We've also consulted with our ethics office. They provided a supporting memo, so it's my pleasure to recommend that the Commission support and approve the request.
Thank you very much. I'd like to say I met with Art and the representatives from Cogle, and Cogle is one of the most respected conferences and the groups that are out there, and I'm very proud to say that we have been active, and even prouder to say that we have a shot to be even more active by helping co-sponsor this event next year. So I assume we will have Commission support for it. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is a great idea. I've been attending COGL conferences for years, and I always find them to be a great opportunity to network with our colleagues, particularly at the state and local level, sometimes at the international level. We've got another conference coming up in a few weeks that we won't be co-sponsoring because it's not here in Washington, but I'm really glad that we're going to be able to do this with COGL. And I want to take this opportunity also to say that at this year's COGL conference in a few weeks, our own Patricia Young is getting a special award from this national organization, this international organization, for her fine work over the years, and we're all very proud of her.
Absolutely. And congratulations, Pat, sitting here. And we're all very proud of her. She's a wonderful employee and staff person, a great leader, and so it's I'm glad she's being recognized by people outside the walls. Anything further? Would someone like to just make an informal motion that we support the co-sponsorship? Mr. Vice Chairman?
Do we need to move to vote on this?
I know that we all agree to it. But
yeah, I'm not sure if we need to formalize it with a vote. But
all right, well, I'll just recognize we have unanimous consensus to go ahead. And thank you very much
Being
active and a leader in it. I assume there's no more management administrative matters to discuss. If not, the meeting is adjourned.